On case number 80910, which is Stanton versus Stanton, it is scheduled for a 30-minute argument today, and so there is a cross appeal, I believe, as well. So, counsel, you have 15 minutes. Why don't you go ahead and tell me if you'd like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Just 1 minute, Your Honor.
Okay. And so, well, when we get down to 1 minute, so you're starting at your 15-minute mark. When it gets down to 1 minute, the yellow light will come on and there'll be a tone and you'll need to get yourself stepped away and say you want to reserve the rest, otherwise it runs through it. You understand?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yes. Oh, good point. Okay, so we're before you start, we're making sure that you have a visible clock down there. So, right.
Justice Kadish?
Yes.
Our clocks are showing 00 down here. I don't know what council is seeing.
So I think it's the clock from up here that's the official clock during this argument, so we need to give you a visual of it on a screen, I guess. And IT personnel are working on that as we speak. No matter how much we plan, we can't always get everything. It's okay.
If it would be helpful, Your Honors, I could use my phone to follow along.
That's
on the
just
time.
What I was wondering.
And I mean, I can see the visual, I think, with the yellow light in Carson City, so I think that would be fine.
Yeah, perhaps you could do that. And then perhaps Justice Kadish, when it gets to his point, could just alert you.
Sure. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Then let's go ahead and begin. Sorry for that confusion.
No problem. May it please the court, John Savage, on behalf of appellant and cross-respondent Dennis Stanton. Mr. Stanton is also present here today, as is respondent and cross-appellant Twyla Stanton, who is in the audience today in Las Vegas, and my understanding her counsel is in Carson City. Mr. Stanton and Mrs. Stanton are currently living together, raising their 8 children together. They are living as a married couple. They hope and believe they are remarried at this point. Representing Mr. Stanton in this appeal has been a unique experience for me. I do not regularly practice in family law, so I had the opportunity to learn a new area of law. And also, I was not involved in developing the record below, so much like this court, I had to sift through the record to find evidence of what happened below at the trial court level, or the district court level.
Right.
And after I got through a little bit of a complicated procedural history, what jumped out to me were 3 fundamental errors the district court made. And those errors were, one, allowing Mrs. Stanton's mother and stepfather, who I refer to today as the Crawfords, their last name, to seek relief in the Stanton's divorce proceeding, despite lacking any standing to do so, and despite failing to move to intervene in the divorce proceeding pursuant to NRCP 24. The second fundamental error that I saw was that the district court set aside the Stanton's divorce decree based on disputed allegations of fraud and incapacity. And the third error was awarding the Crawfords $3,000 in sanctions for attorney's fees allegedly incurred against Mr. Stanton under Rule 11, again, based on disputed allegations of fraud. And this time, despite the Crawfords' failure to serve Mr. Stanton with a Rule 11 safe harbor letter, and also without conducting a proper Brunzell analysis. Now, the district court's second and third errors, I believe, primarily stem from the court's failure to hold an evidentiary hearing to adjudicate these disputed allegations of fraud and, to a lesser extent, capacity. Because of this failure, there's no admissible evidence in the record to support the district court's finding that fraud occurred to justify setting aside the divorce decree and sanctioning Mr. Stanton. Now, I would like to, before expanding on those three errors, read into the record some excerpts from the transcript of the hearing on the Crawford's motion to set aside the divorce decree and Mr. Stanton's counter motion to strike that pleading. I believe these excerpts really bring to life and illustrate the errors that the district court made. And I do apologize, in preparing for today's oral argument, I did notice that some of our citations to this transcript in our brief, the page and line sites were a little bit off. We had some difficulty with these transcripts, and so I do apologize for that. But the first line I want to look at here, this is volume 2 of our appendix. The transcript itself begins at JA221. And at JA232, line 4, this is the court, and the court states, because I just assumed, and that's one of the problems here, I just assumed, based on her limited mental capacity, that it would be easy for him to manipulate her into a stipulation that he gets custody of the kids. And then at, I'm sorry. And then at JA237, this is page 17 of the transcript, beginning at line 11, this is Mr. Stanton's attorney before the district court. Beginning line 11, their own clients say that Twyla cannot even manage herself or her personal affairs. And that's why she has to have a guardian over both over her person and her estate. And then just skipping down to the court's response on line 18, I want to assure you that if there was a jury here and there was an objection about speculation, I'd sustain it and so forth. Again, demonstrating a lack of evidence to support these allegations.
Mr. Savage, before we get too far down the road on that, let me ask you to address something
Yes.
else as kind of a preliminary matter. My understanding at the hearings below is that your client, through counsel, stated that he was in agreement with setting aside the divorce decree, that even though that wasn't relief that he was seeking originally, he did not oppose that relief, and that, quote, let's dismiss the divorce case. So what's the propriety, and by that I'm speaking to waiver, of him now saying, I want to contest the setting aside of the divorce decree?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. It's my understanding that that was essentially an alternative request, essentially, well, if the court is so inclined, at a very minimum, we cannot impose sanctions against Mr. Stanton at this point because of the various difficulties.
No.
I
understand that. I mean, the idea of sanctions
Yes.
has Rule 11 implications, a lot of other concerns. I'm just talking about the thrust of the appeal today being we're asking to reverse the district court's decision to set aside the decree, even though the record seems to reflect that your client agreed to set aside the decree below.
Well, Your Honor, and again, and my understanding is that my client was opposed to the decree being set aside as a last resort. If that was going to be the only relief granted, that was sort of argued as essentially, I believe, an alternative argument against sanctions. Immediately after the order was entered, Mr. Stanton did file a motion for reconsideration. And I think also Mr. Stanton's counter motion to strike the motion to set aside the divorce decree, again, at least at a minimum, preserved the right to appeal the set aside. Mr. Stanton was affirmatively seeking to set aside, or I'm sorry, to strike that motion on the grounds that the Crawfords lack standing. And I understand that perhaps the court is familiar with the hearing transcript and the points I was trying to get to related to the lack of evidence in the record. And if I could just turn then more directly to the first error of the court by improperly allowing the Crawfords to seek relief in the Stanton's appeal, or I'm sorry, in the Stanton's divorce proceeding. The Stantons have a constitutional right to privacy. That constitutional right to privacy includes the right to marry and the right to divorce. And additionally, Nevada has a public policy interest in protecting valid divorce decrees. Moreover, and this is NRS 125.185, valid divorce decrees in Nevada are not subject to attacks by third persons who are not parties to the divorce.
Well,
in violation,
they were coming into the case because they had been appointed her guardian in Arkansas, correct?
Thank you, Your Honor. And that brings me to my next point. Somehow the Crawfords did obtain a temporary guardianship order in Arkansas. Now, for that foreign guardianship order to have any effect or power in Nevada, it needed to be registered in Nevada pursuant to NRS 159.2027. And in the Crawfords' reply brief, they acknowledge that they failed to register the foreign order. And I believe the reason that they set forth was they didn't have time because the temporary guardianship order was being challenged by Mrs. Stanton. And so that resulted in some additional proceedings. They did not register that foreign guardianship order, so they had no standing in Nevada. That power, that order in Arkansas was ineffective for any purpose here in Nevada. And another point that I think is important to, with the time that I do have today, I do want to make a point of emphasis that temporary guardianship order, that expired in January of 2019 by its own terms and was not extended. And the court's order setting aside the divorce decree was not entered until March of 2019. So not only was the foreign Arkansas order not registered in Nevada as required under Nevada law, but it had expired before the district court ultimately issued the relief the Crawfords sought. So they had absolutely no standing at the time that order was issued to act on behalf of Mrs. Stanton.
But at the time they filed the motion, they were, at least in Arkansas, appointed temporary guardian, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, yes.
And there was a record of that in this case?
Yes, that is correct. There was a record of the Arkansas order, correct, not registered in Nevada, though.
Right. And do you read NRS 1592027 to say that the Arkansas guardianship order is of no effect unless and until it's registered in Nevada?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. Subsection 2 states under that statute, a court of this state may grant any relief available under the Nevada statutes related to guardianship to enforce a registered order. Quote, registered order. This was an unregistered order. And subsection 1 of that statute states, quote, upon registration of a guardianship, then the foreign guardian shall be able to exercise its powers in this state. And we just don't have that here. And that is.
What about the doctrine of comity, where one court will recognize another court's order as a matter of comity between two sovereigns, if you will?
Yes, Your Honor. I am familiar with the doctrine. And I believe when you have a statute on point, I believe the statute governs and takes precedent over a common law doctrine like that. And so here we have a statute in Nevada that expressly states you have to register the order. Then I don't think that doctrine should apply. And if this was a permanent guardianship order that was always going to be enforceable in Arkansas and was actually adjudicated and validated, this was a challenged order. Mrs. Sand disputed that she lacked capacity. She hired an attorney to dispute that order. The order eventually expired on its terms. It was not extended. And the district court just assumed by its own words that Mrs. Stanton lacked capacity. It failed. It never even held an evidentiary hearing to determine that, whether there was any need for guardianship.
Counsel, would you agree that the order could have been registered in Nevada, even though it was a temporary guardianship order? In other words, if a temporary order could be registered in Nevada?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And if the order was registered in Nevada, and again, you know, I think that this argument about the court erring without holding an evidentiary hearing to determine capacity, it's probably a lot weaker, and it probably does not prevail. But this was disputed. This wasn't a adjudicated order. This was something the parents did on an emergency basis that was challenged, and it would terminate even before the district court here ordered its relief. I'm sorry, Justice Kadish, did you have a question?
I do. We're low on time, but my point was that the court granted the motion not necessarily based on a finding of lack of capacity, but based on not having disclosed all the prior proceedings, including efforts to avoid having the assigned judge in the 8th Judicial District Court hear the case.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And I do understand that point, but it does not impact the standing issue, I don't think. I think that Crawford still lacks standing because they didn't register the order. And if I could touch on the alleged fraud, the disputed allegation of fraud.
Okay, I'm just telling you you're at a minute, but go ahead.
And thank you, Your Honor. No need to reserve that minute. I just want to finish up with this. The Stantons used the approved form from the Nye County District Court. They filled in all the information accurately. That form did not ask about prior divorce proceedings. If that form had asked for that information would have been provided. The district court cannot find it was a fraudulent act for the Stantons to not add that information in when that form did not ask for that information. Mm. And finally, Your Honor, just real briefly on the third error regarding sanctions. The Crawford's attorney never sent a safe harbor letter. The district court never did a Brunzell analysis. And then even if the district court was going to sua sponte issue sanctions, the rule still requires an order to show cause. So we have an opportunity for hearing to defend against that. That didn't happen. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I know time's up, but yes. I'm going to ask anyway. What's the basis for jurisdiction over this divorce action in the 5th Judicial District Court to start with?
Well, Your Honor, I was looking into that myself.
Uh-huh.
And I would agree.
And I appreciate when you take pro bono appointments. So.
Yes, and I would agree under NRS 125.020, at the outset originally that was the inappropriate court for the divorce proceeding. The venue requires the parties to be a resident of the county where the divorce proceeding is filed, or for a cause of action to occur in that county. And I don't believe that happened here. But, Your Honor, there are two cases on point that establish precedent where a district court that enters a divorce decree without jurisdiction, this court has upheld that twice in Valley Oh, at least once, in Valley, V-A-I-L-E versus 8th Judicial District Court. That is 118 Nevada 262, 2002 case. And the court there said the district court should be very interested in ascertaining whether jurisdiction actually exists before granting the decree so that decrees are valid and enforceable and interested persons can rely on them. And the court added that we realize that the posture of this case is unusual and unique since we are refusing to void a decree which was entered, as it turns out, by a court which had no jurisdiction over the parties. There was a similar holding and analysis rationale in Belender versus Markham, 110 Nevada 972. This is from the 1994 case. And so what we had here, Your Honor, the information on the joint petition for divorce stated that the parties resided in Las Vegas. And if that defeated jurisdiction, which I admit maybe originally should have, the district court should have realized that and shouldn't have entered the divorce decree to begin with, perhaps. But at this point, we had a valid divorce decree entered. The parties were divorced. And then to complicate matters, which I think is one of the reasons we're here, the parties remarried. They amicably resolved their differences and remarried December 14th of 2018. So now the problem we're faced with is, well, if the divorce decree on June 7th of 2018 is invalidated, what is the status of the relationship? And if they are married, what is the valid date of the beginning of their marriage for community property and you know, other practical concerns?
I have a question, if I might.
Sure. Go ahead, Justice Herndon.
And I know we're over time, so I'll try and make it brief, Mr. Savage. But I want to go back to something you said a moment ago about the form that Dennis and Twyla filled out, and I apologize, I'm just going to use their first names for purposes of this, didn't have anywhere to say anything about her mental capacity issue. So is it your position that despite Judge Hughes finding in the 8th Judicial District Court that she had a diminished mental capacity and could not understand legal documents and make legal decisions, that when they filed the joint petition in the 5th, where she essentially gave up her marital home, gave up primary and legal custody of the children, and agreed to pay child support and arrears, that there was no obligation on Dennis to alert the court to what had been found previously?
Your Honor, and I just wanted to clarify, I wasn't speaking specifically about the capacity issue when I was referring to the joint petition. But again, Your Honor, I don't believe there is an obligation to inform the court of any information that's not called for by the form. But going back to Judge Hughes's finding, as Your Honor put it, that was issued by a minute order. And Your Honor, pursuant to this court's precedent in Rust versus Clark County School District, 103 Nevada 686, 1987 case, minute orders are ineffective for any purpose. So this wasn't, again, this was not, as far as I'm aware, a finding of the court. This was a statement issued in a minute order that the fifth Judicial District Court relied on. And again, I think that was improper to rely on a minute order. And I think the proper thing to do here would have been to hold an evidentiary hearing at a minimum to determine whether Mrs. Stanton did have capacity, especially considering the problems we have with the unregistered Arkansas foreign guardianship order.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much for your argument. All right. So now we have Mr. Burke here. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Christopher Burke for respondent, cross appellant. Ms. Stanton, I want to initially just thank Mr. Savage for the fine job he did on his brief. My argument will be fairly brief, and to the extent I have any time left over and the court wants to ask Mr. Savage additional questions, he's welcome to my time, just so the court knows. The two main issues here, at least from Ms. Stanton's standpoint, one, the diminished capacity, and then two, the conflict of counsel. In terms of her diminished capacity, I've met with her and spoken to her a number of times. She is not mentally challenged in the least. She came on her own. We spoke. In fact, she speaks better than most of the clients I deal with. And so I don't know where this came from and how it...
And counsel, did you meet with her alone without Mr. Stanton's presence?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And we've spoken on the phone a few times, and again, I read somewhere in the record about a IQ of 69, utterly ridiculous. And I know it's not evidence, but when I first was asked to do this case pro bono and the mention of diminished capacity came up, I thought this is going to be difficult, but fine, I said I would do it. And then when I met with her, I was just flabbergasted that this was even an issue. So that's the first problem, and everything emanates from that. If there was no diminished capacity, we wouldn't have went down this road, and I think the district court wouldn't have.
Perhaps they would have stayed in the 8th Judicial District Court where the case should have been.
Perhaps they should have, Judge.
That wasn't you, right?
No, it wasn't me. And I would say that that's not so uncommon. I don't do family law, but those I know who do, they say their clients get divorced in different counties frequently. They don't want people to know in the county they are. So I think it happens a lot more than maybe the court's aware. Right or wrong, I don't know, because I'm not in that area. So although not evidence before this court, I can tell the court she has no diminished capacity. Second, so putting aside everything else, because this court has fleshed out its concerns with the argument of the appellant, Ms. Stanton does want the divorce decree restored or enforced. It shouldn't have been set aside. And as appellant counsel noted, they got remarried and they're still remarried. So the only issue left for Ms. Stanton and of perhaps some interest of this court writing on is the fact of the potential conflict with the counsel. Counsel represented her in a prior divorce, then agreed to represent her mom and stepdad in trying to undo the divorce decree. It wasn't in writing, and even if there was a diminished capacity concern, somehow another counsel should have perhaps been appointed to her, not her old attorneys representing her parents, and that's the concern there.
Let me interrupt you, if I may, sir, and ask a question similar to what I asked Mr. Savage about the waiver issue. I mean, your position today is that Twyla has good mental capacity. She understands everything and is not disabled at all in that regard, correct?
Correct.
She knew about the proceedings that were going on where her parents were acting as guardian in the Nevada court seeking to set aside the decree, correct?
Yes.
She did not seek to intervene in that or do anything to assert a desire to not set aside the decree. So, again, along those same lines, what's the propriety of her now coming before this court on an appeal on the setting aside of the decree? Did she waive that issue by not involving herself below if, as you say, she had mental capacity to do so?
I'm not sure she realized the consequences of what was going on. And what she did do, though, is on the motion to reconsider, she had a non-opposition. So she did appear and state her position on that.
She filed what? Sorry.
A non-opposition.
To?
The motion for reconsideration.
Thank you.
So help me here. This is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas. Just thinking about this case, they went to 8th Judicial District, never did get divorced, tried a few times but didn't get one, went to the 5th Judicial District, got a divorce, then remarried, and then the divorce was set aside. And so legally, if we were to affirm the decree setting aside the divorce, what is the consequence to Mrs. Stanton? Legally, what is the harm? Because you're saying that she wants to have the settlement of property rights and custodial rights as of the date of the Fifth Judicial District Court divorce govern her rights going forward? Is that the wrong that we're looking at? Or not wrong, but alteration in rights? I mean, is that what this is about?
I don't think that's her perspective. Her perspective is they were divorced and then they got remarried. And to set it aside creates problems in the future going forward when it comes to property rights, perhaps.
Well, if the divorce decree stands, then she lost all of her rights in the home. She owes apparently back child support, which she has no apparent means of paying. So, I mean, is that what you're asking for?
Well, I think the fact that they're remarried changes the landscape on that.
Well, I mean, I suppose they could reach a new agreement about whether the home is community property or not, but I don't know. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying the position of Ms. Stanton is to restore the divorce decree and that the reconsideration motion should have been granted and there shouldn't have been sanctions. She's on board for all that.
Okay. And I understand the legal issues regarding the sanctions. So I guess, at least from my perspective, and I think my colleagues, that to sort of separate whether the sanctions were proper from whether the decree should have been set aside. But I want to be clear that her position is she wants to keep that decree in place, which includes all those provisions about child support and community property, et cetera. All of those things would remain in place if the decree remains in place.
Understood, yes.
And that's what she's that's what you're asking for on her behalf today.
Yes.
And I want to follow up on that, because thinking about this case, if we set aside the sanction order, I'm just thinking out loud, let's put that to one side. Let's pretend that the sanction order is not in play or that it's reversed. What is to her advantage in having the decree restored, given that she married again after the decree? Because it leaves her with no title to the house and back due child support.
Well, going forward, she would have an interest in the house from the time they got remarried.
Not if it's a separate property before they get married, unless they do something to change that. I think there's ways to do that, but I'm no expert on that field.
Which doesn't either contemplate what happens if the remarriage gets annulled for some reason, which would reinstitute the divorce decree with judgments against her, lack of marital home, lack of custody of children, et cetera.
And perhaps that falls in line with what I was saying about having independent counsel and the potential conflict of counsel, because that could have been fleshed out.
And the conflict, to be clear, the asserted conflict is that counsel who had represented her represented the Crawfords as her guardians in this proceeding.
Correct. And she didn't agree to that in writing. Now, I know the other argument is, okay, well, maybe she wasn't mentally able to, although she was. Even if she wasn't, somebody else should have been appointed, maybe by the court, to help her out with that. I just think they shouldn't have taken over for the parents to go against her. They found out different things during the divorce, obviously, that they could have used to their advantage. And one thing that was pointed out was this little oral minute hearing, which said she had diminished capacity, which is what created this whole thing, because that was so obscure.
Isn't that before counsel was her counsel? Isn't that what led to them becoming her counsel?
It may have, but the point is that was an obscure entry that probably no other attorneys would have picked up on. Maybe Mr. Savage, he's pretty thorough. But And so they use that either to her disadvantage or to their new client's advantage, and that wasn't right. And so where we stand now is that Ms. Stanton would like the divorce decree restored and for her to be considered remarried as of 2018. And whatever consequences flow from that, that's something she can deal with in the future, but if any. But that's...
Well, with, I don't... Never mind. I don't want to waive privilege, so I won't go there.
And so from our perspective, we ask that the decision of the district court be set aside, or that the motion to reconsider should have been granted, and that the divorce decree remain or be reentered.
I gather that the Crawfords, in whose favor the sanctions were awarded, have apparently not appeared on this appeal. Is that your understanding?
Right. They haven't appeared on this appeal, and I mean, it's like a second cousin twice removed. I'm not sure they should have appeared initially to object to the motion to reconsider, and yet they were allowed to do that. So I guess I'd have to say I'm pleased they're not here.
So did you have a problem with their standing originally, or just their standing on the motion for reconsideration after the guardianship expired by the terms of the Arkansas?
The way I would read the law is initially they weren't registered and they didn't move to intervene, and yet they were allowed to appear.
What is your position, and Justice Pickering referenced this earlier in one of her questions, in terms of the rule of comity? And this court's decision in Baker many years ago that allowed an out-of-state guardian that wasn't registered to represent his sister in Nevada in a divorce proceeding, with the court finding essentially that guardianship statutes act to shield people. They shouldn't be used as a sword against them. They should be used to protect them. So the court said it was okay in that instance without a registration.
Well, the statute says they should have been registered. Now, I can understand a court's concern that somebody may need some help, and so therefore maybe everything doesn't have to be followed. But this is just one of a number of apparent errors that were made in allowing them to participate in the first place, especially with counsel. I could have said, well, counsel, you need to file a motion. You need to get registered.
And it's my understanding your client didn't appear at the hearing where the court entered the order.
Yeah. In talking with Ms. Stanton, some of the proceedings she wasn't aware of. If there's no further questions, I guess I used up my time I was going to give to Mr. Savage.
I think we're good.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions for either Mr. Burke or Mr. Savage?
Okay. Not from me, Justice Kedish.
Thank you. All right. Again, I appreciate, as I mentioned to Mr. Savage, I do appreciate counsel who agree to accept these kind of appointments. It's very helpful for us to have counsel on board for a case like this. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to be in a brief recess to get set up for the next argument. This case will stand submitted.